world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Of the 7,000-ish languages that exist across the world, almost half are set to disappear by the end of the century. What does it mean for a language to be endangered? And is there any hope to protect them before their last fluent speakers die out? And it's not just languages that are under threat. Scottish wildcats are getting a little too cozy with the cuter domestic kind, and it's messing with the gene pool. Faced with a real threat of extinction, conservationists hope that reintroducing them back into the wild could help. But first, which country has the world's largest population of internal refugees? The highest number of people facing famine? The answer is not, as many might assume, Gaza or Ukraine. It is Sudan. A year ago, fighting swept across the country. Today, the conflict seems no closer to a conclusion, and its consequences are proving devastating.
It's hard to overstate the humanitarian crisis right now in Sudan. Mass starvation is imminent.
Tom Gardner writes about Africa for The Economist.
Donors pledged around $2.1 billion earlier this month to fund humanitarian efforts, but it may already be too late to avert a famine, which is expected by the lean season in June.
Before we get into the question of the famine, remind us of the background to this conflict.
Yeah, so the fighting began just over a year ago now between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, the National Army and a rival paramilitary group. Each was, to start with, under the command of a sort of single power-hungry general, and it could have been mistaken at the time as a relatively clear-cut fight between two rival armies. But in the course of the last year, the conflict has widened into this nationwide conflagration, so vast and anarchic, it could yet destabilize several of Sudan's neighbors. And that's the backdrop to this impending famine.
Give me a sense of scale here, Tom.
Sure. So The Economist spoke with Michael Dunford, who runs the UN's World Food Programme in East Africa.
The situation is catastrophic. When you look at the sheer size and scale, we're desperately concerned about where this is headed.
Mr. Dunford was reluctant to give numbers, but a Dutch think tank, the Klingendael Institute, were more forthright in a report released earlier this year. They outlined two scenarios, likely and extreme. And in the likely scenario, it estimated some 500,000 people will die across the country from hunger or related diseases. But in its extreme scenario, up to 1 million people may perish. And that's because large parts of Sudan have collected almost no harvest in the course of the past 12 months.
The big concern we have at the moment is that the last harvest is significantly down, probably 45% of what had been produced previously. There's simply not the levels of availability of food in the markets.
Price of basic foods has shot up by as much as 83%. And Mr. Dunford told us that humanitarian aid just isn't reaching enough people.
We're probably only reaching about 10% on a monthly basis. We don't have the humanitarian access that is required to be able to meet the needs of the population.
What's really worrying is that these trends are set to get even worse as fighting has now reached Jazeera. That's in the east. That's one of the primary breadbasket states in Sudan. And in fact, the situation is so bad that some projections are suggesting now that more than 1 million people could die in the coming months.
Why is it so hard to get aid to these people?
Well, of course, the fighting between the two main protagonists, but also multiple militias and rebel groups that have more recently joined the fray, that makes it hard for aid agencies to get help where it's needed in the worst affected areas, including the capital, Khartoum.
And it's not just two sides of the conflict. There are all these other militias that we need to negotiate.
Complicating matters further, troops from both sides are stopping humanitarian assistance.
So we did a convoy recently, I think 30-plus trucks from Port Sudan to North Darfur. It took us over 3 weeks because at various points along the route, we needed to stop, negotiate before we can move on.
Fighters from the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, regularly attack aid lorries and loot warehouses belonging to NGOs. Meanwhile, in February, the Sudanese Armed Forces, the army, banned aid agencies from delivering supplies via neighbouring Chad to the west. Since then, it has partially relented, but it continues to withhold visas and travel permits for aid workers. At the same time, aid officials say that crossing the lines between territory controlled by the two sides in order to deliver assistance is cumbersome and, to quote, deliberately time-consuming. Whole regions have now for months been cut off from emergency supplies. The upshot is that food crises, which are not unusual in Sudan's history, but used to be predominantly localized, now there is a nationwide food emergency.
So is it safe to say that a famine is inevitable now?
The UN has yet to declare a famine due to certain technicalities, but the reality is few experts doubt that one is actually already underway in parts of Sudan, including the capital and including Darfur in the west. In the worst affected areas, for example, aid workers report people being forced to eat leaves just to survive. Children are already beginning to die from malnutrition or related diseases. In a refugee camp in Darfur, it is estimated that one child dies every 2 hours. For most of the last year, refugees arriving in Chad said they were escaping ethnic cleansing unleashed by RSF troops and allied Arab militias against the local population there. Now, however, the new arrivals tell aid workers they are fleeing hunger.
Tom, what could bring an end to this war?
Well, the trouble is the state has largely collapsed and both sides have begun to splinter limited command and control over their forces. That makes it really difficult to see a negotiated end to the conflict anytime soon. Nonetheless, discrete ceasefire talks are underway in Egypt, and a separate process backed by America is set to resume in Saudi Arabia soon. I am quite skeptical that these are going to go anywhere particularly productive, at least in the short term. In recent weeks, the army has reversed some of the RSF's earlier gains, particularly in Khartoum. That's raised hope among some of its supporters of a decisive victory. But just a few weeks before that, it had been the RSF that appeared triumphant. People were talking about a total RSF victory. So I think both sides still remain resolute in their determination to gain the upper hand, which to my mind means that the prospect of a lasting peace probably is as slim as it was a year ago.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ori.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
سلام علیک کلی مردم یک زبان بر خواست خواهیش دارم که
What you're listening to is the Wahi language. It has around 40,000 speakers worldwide and is spoken in remote regions of Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, and Tajikistan. But like many of the world's languages, it is under threat.
Lane Green is The Economist's language columnist.
In fact, nearly half the world's languages are not expected to survive to the end of this century. The decline is often put down to two main reasons, colonialism and capitalism, and the death of a language often tends to follow the same pattern.
And why does that pattern repeat itself?
Conquest and colonization lead to poverty and second-class status for many people, so parents will often choose to take the tragic decision to raise their children in another, bigger language for economic reasons, thinking that they're doing so in their children's own good. If a language has been imposed by the government on schools, it could be that local languages have been relegated to private and intimate and family environments, or even banned outright in some extreme cases. We also have to look at capitalism's effects. When countries grow and get richer, people move to the cities to get work, and more they'll end up speaking the bigger languages used in those cities and used at workplaces, languages of wider communication, rather than the smaller one that they use at home. And whether those languages then disappear altogether usually depends on the next generation of speakers who may assimilate and decide to forget the old language entirely, but in some cases raise the alarm and try to reverse the decline of the language before the last fluent native speakers die out entirely.
Is anything being done to stop some of the world's threatened languages from disappearing for good?
Yes, there are revitalization efforts going on all around the world. And in the story I did on this subject, we look at a nonprofit called the Endangered Language Alliance, which has identified around 700 languages spoken in New York City alone and its metropolitan area. That's a lot more than the 100 or so that had been listed previously in the official American census records. The Big Apple is actually the most linguistically diverse spot on Earth. And the co-founder of the Endangered Language Alliance, Ross Perlin, has a new book out called Language City, where he tells the story of what he's learned on this project. He's profiled in the book speakers of six languages, with each of them threatened by larger neighbors. The people he meets, they are often very multilingual out of necessity. The smaller the language you speak at home, the more important it is for you to learn other languages to get by. But they refuse to stop using their cherished family and home languages in order to preserve the cultures that are associated with those languages.
Tell me a bit more about some languages that Ross considered under threat.
Seke, which is spoken in Nepal. It's a language finding itself squeezed between Nepali from the south and Tibetan from the north. And that's Wahi. That's the language we heard at the start of this chat. It's spoken also in Central Asia, but well to the west there. And it sits between really huge world languages, Chinese, Persian, and Russian. And its speakers are also usually fluent in Tajik, which is the language of Tajikistan, where most of the speakers of Wahi live. That's another language giving way to one of the big world languages. That was Nahuatl, which is spoken in Mexico and is giving way to Spanish. Nahuatl is spoken by more than 1.5 million indigenous Mexicans, so it's by no means a really tiny language. Some languages are spoken by just a few people.
Lane, what can be done to prevent languages from becoming extinct?
Fundamentally, languages go extinct when parents no longer speak the language to their child while raising them, and the children grow up without the ability to speak the language. So what you need to do is give parents the spaces and the places where those languages can be spoken. That means a focus on things like schools so that kids can get educated in those languages, at least partially. That means things like technology tools. Young people want to know that they can use those in the languages that we're talking about here. Otherwise, they might find them sort of second rank. So it's important to make those spaces and places available. This kind of thing is happening in countries that have recognized the problem and have recognized that they've in the past done real wrongs to the indigenous peoples of their territories. But those places tend to be wealthy democracies, so places like the United States and Canada or Australia, New Zealand. But a lot of language loss is happening in undemocratic places where the rulers might think that small tribal languages or indigenous languages are kind of a pain and they really wish they would go away. So it's really down to the experts, sometimes outsiders, to raise the alarm on what's happening and to show what they have learned from the past in their countries so it doesn't continue happening in the future.
Lane, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the calls of a Scottish wildcat. It's a sound that's echoed across parts of Scotland for thousands of years. But this one is yowling in the country's Highland Wildlife Park. Her wild counterparts are harder to find. Estimates are difficult to make, but their total population may be below 100, meaning that they're alarmingly close to extinction. But efforts to reverse this trend could offer some hope.
New footage has been recorded that shows Scottish wildcats stalking, chasing, and generally looking adorably cute and furry up in the Cairngorms.
Catherine Nixie is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
And this footage is the delightful outcome of a successful reintroduction attempt there. It's very welcome news for this declining species.
Why has the species become so rare?
There are so many reasons that the Scottish wildcat is in trouble. One is that people have been hunting it for centuries. The other is habitat loss. But actually, the biggest threat comes not from violence, but from love. It's hybridization. So their greatest danger to the Scottish wildcat is not when it's murdered by hunters, but when it's seduced by the amorous approaches of other, much less wild, domestic cats. And when that happens, their genes get watered down. That changes how they behave and also how they mate. So it becomes this sort of vicious cycle of domestication. So to prevent that, conservationists at the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland have been raising kittens for reintroduction. And it's going really well. So they released 19 wildcats into the Cairngorms National Park last year. And this year, they hope 20 more will be released.
So reintroducing these wildcats back into the wild, won't there just be more interbreeding?
Exactly. And that's precisely the concern. So as well as reintroducing wildcats into the wilds of Scotland, the conservationists are also attempting to neuter free-roaming domestic cats that live in the same area. And if the domestic cats are neutered, then the genetic future of these reintroduced cats should be safe.
But what about the poor domestic cats? I mean, I'm not even a cat person, but has anyone asked them how they feel about this?
Well, this is what really interested me. I mean, we don't know what it's like to be a castrated cat, but it is an interesting question. So I asked an expert in animal behaviour. And animal behaviour people think a lot about this kind of stuff. There was a philosopher called Thomas Nagel who wrote an essay called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? Now, no one's written an essay called What Is It Like to Be a Castrated Cat? But it is, my expert told me, an interesting question. However, he thinks that the answer is probably absolutely fine. He says that cats don't suffer from existential angst over whether or not they're going to have a litter of kittens. And he said that Scotland is not going to become the land of a bunch of sad cats, as he put it. But if it all goes to plan, Scotland could once again become the land of the wildcat.
Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. You can get in touch at podcasts@economist.com. and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.